realize it means. But Matthew chapter 13 and verse 24. He, Jesus, put another parable before them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field." Now, when Jesus says the kingdom of heaven may be compared, he's saying it's sort of like this. It's not completely like this. This isn't a direct analogy, but it's sort of like this. A man sowed good seed in his field, verse 25. "But while his men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared also. And the servants of the master of the house came and said to him, 'Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have weeds?' He said to them, 'An enemy has done this.' So the servants said to him, 'Then do you want us to go and gather them, gather the weeds?' He said, 'No, lest in gathering the weeds you root up the wheat along with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and at harvest time I will tell the reapers, gather the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" Now, Jesus then does a couple other things, and then in verse 36, he actually explains the parable after the people leave. So we're going to go forward to this. He explains it to the disciples. Now, just real quick, if you were here last week or the week before, you know that when Jesus told the parable of the sower, his disciples came to him in verse 10. They said, "Why do you speak in parables?" They asked the question, "Why do you speak in parables?" Jesus answered their question, sort of, kind of. Because Jesus often makes the answer bigger than the question. This time they ask a different question. They've learned. They'd say, don't ask that question. Instead, look at what they say. "Can you please explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field?" In other words, please explain this to us, because you said the kingdom of heaven is like this. We're really confused. Now, what does that question tell us about their understanding of the kingdom of heaven right off the bat? What does it tell us? Do you think they have a good understanding of the kingdom of heaven or a bad understanding? A good understanding or a poor understanding? Poor understanding. They don't know how this works, because when Jesus tells this parable, they're like, "Well, that doesn't fit with the way that we've been talking about this." We're going to talk about how people had misunderstood the kingdom of heaven, the coming kingdom. But here's Jesus' explanation. Verse 36, "He left the crowds, went into the house. His disciples came to him saying, 'Explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field.' And he answered," now Jesus is very direct. He says, "The one who sows the seed, good seed, is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed is the sons of the kingdom. The weeds are the sons of the evil one. And the enemy who sowed them is the devil," or the accuser. The Greek word literally means the one who hurls accusations. "The harvest is the end of the age. The reapers are angels. Just as the weeds are gathered and burned with fire, so will it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels. They will gather out of his kingdom," and listen very carefully to the way that he phrases that. He says, "They will gather them out of his kingdom, all causes of sin and all lawbreakers, and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear." Now, I'm not going to dwell on this, but Jesus tells a parable. We've talked about this. A parable is always a piece of discourse that uses story or analogy to impart wisdom greater than the words themselves. So what Jesus is saying is bigger than the "this is this and this is this and this is this." He's getting to a much bigger idea, but he gives them a very direct analogy there. And Jesus presents them with what we call an eschatology. And you say, "What on earth is an eschatology?" I'm so glad you asked that. I am so glad that you asked that. That was the slide that should have been up here. Jesus actually, in the parable, he is going to give us two what are called eschatological parables or apocalyptic parables. In commentaries, they're often called the greater apocalypse and the lesser apocalypse, because that clears everything up. So apocalypse is a Greek word. It means revealed. If you were here years ago when I taught about the book of Revelation, the word revelation is a translation of the Greek word apokalypsis. It means the revealing, or rather the springing forth. It's used to describe in Greek literature something that is hidden, like a spring under the ground that suddenly erupts from the ground. That is an apokalypsis. And so it's something that exists but is hidden. I don't like to use that word to describe a lot of this literature because it kind of assumes a parallel between some of the things we're going to talk about that existed in Judaism at Jesus' day and what Jesus is presenting. What Jesus is presenting is eschatological, and what eschatos, the Greek word eschatos, means the end or the last, all right, at the end of a sequence. And so eschatological are things that happen at the end. So eschatology is the discipline of theology that eventually Ray Pouliot will teach on in a couple of years. He's got to do leadership, church leadership, and he's going to do angels, and we're going to talk about soteriology and all kinds of other ologies. All right, but eschatology is the study of end times. What happens when you die? What happens at the end of the world? All of those kind of questions, those are eschatological questions. Eschatology, by the way, is the most diverse and the most confusing branch of systematic theology. There is so many beliefs about the end times, and that's why I'm going to let Ray teach it. I'm content with Jesus is coming, the details are fuzzy. I'll just go with that. Eschatological, that's what it is. Well, Jesus is going to present two eschatological parables. This one, and then he's going to give one about a net and fish. What Jesus is doing is he's giving these disciples some insight into the end of the age. What are things going to look like at the end of the world? Now, why is that so important? It's so important because Second Temple Judaism, the belief systems of the people around Jesus, were highly motivated by this kind of thing. And they wrote a lot of stuff about it, and it's mostly wrong. But they created a whole literature about the end of the world. Well, why was that so important to them? Why were they so obsessed with what happens at the end of the world? The Old Testament isn't really obsessed with that. There's not really an Old Testament kind of revelation book where, all right, this is the end of everything. So there's pieces in Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel. There are pieces about what's going to happen at the end. My favorite eschatological prophet is Haggai. I'm always constantly talking about the earth shaking and all kinds of stuff. But they don't really deal too much like in detail. But when Judaism was dominated by the Greeks, when the Greeks conquered Israel around 300 BC, The Greeks ruled over them, and there was a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus IV. He was a terrible person, really, really awful person. And he set up a situation where the Jews were really, really in rough shape. They revolted against him, established a kingdom, what's called the Hasmonean or the Maccabean kingdom. And that lasted for a little while. And then Rome took over, and the Jews were obsessed with the idea of, when are we going to get back what we lost back in the day? When are we going to get back the Davidic kingdom when David was king and his descendants were king? When are we going to get back total control of Jerusalem? When are we going to get rid of these dirty, stinking, non-kosher Gentiles? And that was really what they were obsessed with. When do the Gentiles get judged so that we can be very visibly and clearly God's favorite again? And they developed a lot of eschatology about that. I want to talk very briefly just about a couple, because these have all come to light. We didn't really know details about them until the 20th century. In the 1940s, there were a bunch of fragments of scrolls that were found in these caves in Qumran, which is in the Judean wilderness near the Dead Sea. And because the weather was so dry where it was, these scrolls actually lasted for 2,000 years. They were stored in bottles. So some of them fell apart. But some of them were in really good shape. One of them is the great Isaiah scroll, which is almost the entire text of the book of Isaiah. But then there was another one called what we call the War Scroll, or the War of the Children of Light and the Children of Darkness. And this scroll, which was found in the first cave, there are seven caves, so the documents are dated because archaeologists are really inventive. 1Q, which means first Qumran, to 7Q, 7 Qumran, right? I mean, that's pretty straightforward. So you can always tell which cave something was found. And the war scroll is 1Q21. It's a pretty hefty scroll. And what this scroll deals with is the final battle between light and darkness. Anyone want to guess who represents the light? The Jews, right? The Jews. And anyone want to guess who the darkness is? The Gentiles. All right, not just the Gentiles, but also all the Jews that aren't part of the sect that wrote the document. All right, so it's a literally, the document is called the Children of Light, the War of the Children of Light and Darkness, and the Children of Darkness. And the Children of Light are the ones who wrote the book, and the Children of Darkness are everybody else. It is the ultimate us and them document. And so at the Israel Museum, this is what this picture is, at the Israel Museum, when they built a museum to house the Dead Sea Scrolls, what's called the Shrine of the Book, and that little red thing is the representation, it's the symbol of the Israel Museum down in the corner there. The Shrine of the Book is this white building here on your left. Looks like the end of a scroll. You see how it looks like the end of the scroll? All right, now what's really cool about it is inside it originally was the great Isaiah scroll wrapped around a giant cylinder. Now today it's a replica, but it was originally the great Isaiah scroll. And this whole thing collapses in case of nuclear war. It collapses and pushes the Qumran collection under the ground to keep it safe. It's kind of cool. The Israelis kind of designed this cool thing. So the Children of Light are represented by that. You see that black rectangle that looks like 2001 Space Odyssey over on the right? That's a basalt block, and it's called, and that's the monument of the Children of Darkness. And it really represents the entire story of the War Scroll. The War Scroll, those who are the light are those who have heard from God. Notice that the shrine, if you can see it, there are sprinklers blasting water on top of it because it's life and truth. And people go into the white shrine. The black shrine is just a block. It's dead. It's separated. It's apart. Because the war scroll says, we, the people of the Qumran sect, we are God's favorite. Everybody else is darkness. Right? This is the kind of eschatology that exists in Judaism. It's the us versus them Judaism judgment. It is we're special, and anybody that ain't us, they hate us because they ain't us. Right? And that is the way that they think. All right, they are pushing the line. One of the other texts that was found in Qumran is something called the Book of Enoch. Now, if you listen to podcasts about the Bible or have ever read books by Mike Heiser, who was a scholar who passed away a couple years ago, was one of my professors, wrote a book called The Unseen Realm, he wrote a bunch of stuff. 90% of it was garbage. And I told him that he really appreciated when I said that. The Christian brother, he was just wrong. The Book of Enoch has gotten a lot of media attention because a lot of scholars will say, well, the New Testament authors borrowed a lot from the Book of Enoch. In particular, they isolate this one thing when Jesus says, when they ask him to explain what the parable is, and in verse 37, he says, the one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. Well, the Book of Enoch often refers to the Messiah as the Son of Man. And so the argument is, well, see, so the Christian authors, the authors of the Bible, because they don't actually believe, most people that would make this argument, question whether the Gospels actually represent the words of Jesus. They're kind of, this is the way that people kind of memorized, remembered what Jesus had to say, but they didn't get it exactly right. And the authors of the New Testament, right, they kind of remembered Jesus, and they were so informed by the Book of Enoch that they saw Jesus in terms of what the Book of Enoch taught. Now, there's a couple problems with this. Number one, Jesus didn't get Son of Man from the book of Enoch. He got it from Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, where the Messiah is called, guess what? The Son of Man. That's where he got it from. He didn't get it from the book of Enoch. There's no reason to assume. I always love when scholars read something obvious and go, nah, that can't be it, and go find something obscure. Just go with the obvious answer. Jesus got it because Jesus read the book of Daniel, and Jesus was the Messiah, and it talked about him. He said, I'm going to call myself the Son of Man, so everybody has no doubt about who I am. Then modern scholars came along and doubted who he was. Don't listen to the modern scholars, but Jesus may have been familiar with the book of Enoch, but I seriously doubt it. The reason I seriously doubt it, the book of Enoch, if I were to find a modern equivalent of the book of Enoch, it would be a flat earther on TikTok. This book is caboodles of kooky dookie. It is ridiculous. This book is insane. You read the book of Enoch, there is no way. Forget the Son of God and the Messiah taking it at value. Normal, rational human beings would not take this book at value. How many of you saw the really, really awful Noah movie with the guy from Gladiator, Russell Crowe, in it? How many of you saw that movie? How many of you enjoyed it? That movie is based on the book of Enoch. As crazy as that movie is, that's the book of Enoch. You go, they're like rock monster walking. Yeah. That's why Jesus did not go read the book of Enoch. Go, this is good stuff. I'm gonna teach like this. I have a hard time believing it. They're flat earth TikTokers. That's what book of Enoch is. But the book of Enoch's got all kinds of nuts stuff in it, and it's eschatological. And guess what the book of Enoch is all about? The book of Enoch is all about the angels, the supernatural beings, fighting the demons, and the angels are protecting, guess who? This particular group of Jews from everybody who the demons have control of, and guess who the demons have control of? Everybody else. So what was the Jewish eschatology about? It's about us, the persecuted minority, being driven apart by the Romans or the Gentiles or whatever. It just occurred to me, they're Marxists. Because the Marxist argument is the oppressed must always be correct. That's why the news media is so insane today. But anyway, I'm now going to have to think about that. I'm going to remember. All right, that's going to make a great article no one will ever read. All right, so the Marxists are over here. All right, the Jewish apocalypse, the Jewish eschatological people are saying, we've got our little small minority. They're oppressed by everybody else. God is one day going to come, and he's going to rescue us. He's going to scoop us out. And everybody else is going to be in rough shape. So Jesus takes the idea of their eschatology and he flips it upside down. This is where Jesus is genius. And I know, Son of God, God the Son, the Messiah, I know all that stuff. But Jesus as a teacher and as a speaker, it's a genius. Because look at how he tells the story. He said, okay, the kingdom of heaven is like what? It's like a man who went and sowed his field, right? So the man sows his field and he sows good seed in the field, right? So the Son of Man sows good seed in his field. And then he says, the sower is the Son of Man, the good seed is the sons of the kingdom, and the field is the world, right? So he says, the Son of Man sowed his good seed around the world, in the world, he sowed it. And when would you sow those seeds? During the day, right? So in the light of day, in front of everybody, with nothing hidden. What does apocalypse mean? It means the hidden, all right? Things that are hidden that are going to be revealed. Jesus says, I'm doing this in the light of day. He will later tell when he's accused. He will say, I was in the temple all day long saying these things, and you guys came and got me at night. Why? See, Matthew is constructing a careful narrative. Look at what happens at night in the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus is in the day. He sows the good seed in his field. But while his men are asleep, what happens? The accuser, the devil, the evil one, he comes when? During the day? at night, in the darkness. See how Jesus is playing with the sons of light, the sons of darkness, right? So he says, the devil comes in the darkness. So yeah, the devil, he works in the darkness. That's right. That's true. That's correct. Devil works in the darkness. Yeah. He says he comes in the darkness and he sowed tares. I remember I mentioned that the word tare comes from Arabic. The word tare, the Greek word and the Arabic word and the English word means garbage. What it actually is, it's a plant, all right, they call it false wheat. It's a plant that looks like emmer wheat, which is the kind of wheat that you would spread in the fields. It looks like wheat all the time that it's growing up, right? But, and it actually looks like wheat even when it heads and the kernels come up, but it harbors a fungus that if that is put in flour with the wheat, it will kill people. Looks just like wheat in every way. So only an expert can recognize that there's something not right here. Now you have to ask the question, how did they know that this was growing up? It's getting to the harvest, the grain's starting to get up, and I picture these workers walking the field going, that doesn't look right. I don't remember that there. And investigating, going, oh no, this is false wheat, all right? So the devil, he sows it, but the Son of Man, he sows it where? In the world, which is his field. But what does the devil do when he's done? In the parable, Jesus says, the devil, he went, he sowed the tares among the good, and then he went away. He says, the devil just, he drops in, causes chaos, and then disappears. All right? That's what he does. He's going to drop in, he's going to cause chaos, and he's going to disappear. And then the workers, right? The workers come to Jesus and they come to the Son of Man. They say, hey, look, this guy who had no ownership of this, no purpose to be in this, this enemy, somebody sown this garbage, this dangerous, corrupt, disgusting, false wheat in the midst of a grain. What do we do? And Jesus says, well, the enemy did it. The Son of Man, he says, the enemy did it. The enemy sowed wheat or false wheat along with our wheat. So the worker's response is, do you want us to go in and pull all that out? Now, in the war scroll, one of the points of the sectarianism is we are good, they are evil, we should be pulled out of society. We should separate ourselves from society. We should extract ourselves from that corrupt, terrible, awful world because we're special. All right? Think of the Amish with guns. That's the Qumran society. All right, the militias in Montana, that's the Qumran society. They had a private army. The Mormons in Illinois in the 1850s, they had a private army. They took care of themselves. They had their own economy. All of these things, they were this self-contained. We're going to extract ourselves from the world. We're going to get out of this because the workers say, shouldn't we go through and find the righteous and pull them out so that they're safe? Now, or find the evil and get the evil out so that the righteous are healthy. And what does the owner of the field say? He says, if you do that, there's going to be collateral damage. If you walk around going, we know the difference between righteous and holy, good and corrupt, we're going to make all these decisions, you're going to pluck out some of the good wheat with the bad, and it is more important that the good grows than that the bad be removed. Now that's an interesting idea. It's completely backwards from the way the Jewish eschatologies work, which basically wanted to divide the world into us and them. You know that in the Jewish temple, the temple in Jerusalem, there were a series of courtyards. And the idea was the courtyards where they funneled down to the people that God actually liked. So at the very far end, all the Gentiles got to stand behind this wall. And there were actually signs. The sign said, Gentiles, stop here. And all the Gentiles went, we stop here. And they would stop and they would look over the wall and watch the Jewish temple observance. Then inside that was the court of the women. And there was a sign that said, women, stop here. They ignored it. No, they paid attention. You know, there is a woman, by the way, that does ignore it. Do you know who in the Bible ignores that sign? Mary. She ignores it because Jesus is in there talking as a teenage boy, and she is Mama Bear, and she's going to go get him. And the Jewish aren't, you know, the temple troops are going, just let her through. The woman is terrifying. All right, she grabs Jesus, brings him out. But there was the courtyard of the women, and women were only allowed to go so far. All right, and then they weren't allowed in further in. Then there was a courtyard of the men. So all the Jewish men who were Torah observant, they could go in. There were fees, by the way, you had to pay at each one of these gates. There were like tolls, like, you know, and you get in the court of men. And then inside the court of men was the court of the priests. And inside the court of the priests was the holy place and then the holy of holies. And you funneled down to the people that God actually really liked. And actually, there's a whole thing in the Qumran. There's a thing called the temple scroll that talks about this and how it pertains to who is us and who is them. There's all this division. Yet when Jesus tells a parable about the end time and about dividing between righteous and wicked, what does he say? He says, you know what? You leave the corrupt and the dangerous on the field until the harvest, and we'll separate it when we know for sure. Now, the fate, by the way, of the two. Very interesting the way that Jesus describes this. They will be thrown into the fiery furnace so they will shine like the sun in the Father's kingdom. Now, you read those and you go, okay, what's that? Well, think of it. Have you ever thrown dry grass into a fire? What does it do? Right? Like, poof. You know, that's what it does. It poofs and it's gone. It flares for a second and it's gone. The description shines like the sun. The metaphor for that is when grain has been properly threshed and washed and clean, it's nice and neat and shiny and clean and ready for use. So he says there's going to be two kinds of light in the world. Remember? Everybody's like darkness and he's like there's two kinds of light in the world. There's those that are going to be burned up. And there are those going to shine like the sun. They're going to roast in the sun and be ready and be fruitful and useful and feed people and all that stuff. There's a division between those two. Same soil, same fertilizer, same workers tending it. The enemy's work growing right alongside God's, sometimes indistinguishable from it. And isn't that annoying? As we go through the world, don't we wish that God would come along and tear the tares out so that we, the special ones, could have what we deserve, right? We all fall into that trap. Did Jesus just say that healthy and corrupt things will grow side by side in his kingdom? Remember when I said to watch that line? What does it say in verse 41? The Son of Man will send his angels and they will gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all lawbreakers. Whoa, 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 whoa. Only the righteous get into the kingdom. Only the good. Guess what? We don't know who's who. We don't get to walk around and say, you're good enough to be a part of the kingdom, but you're not, you're out. We are limited in our perspective on whether someone is a believer or not by whether they say it and whether they demonstrate fruit. I grew up in a tradition, by the way, where communion was not something you did every Sunday. In fact, there are very few Baptist churches that do it the way that we do it, where we do it every Sunday in what is called a close communion. So without getting into too big a deal, a closed communion is where you basically have a guest list of who's allowed to come to the table, usually the members of the church. And I've told you this before, but the church I was the assistant pastor of, they literally sent out invitations for communion on Saturday nights about four or five times a year, and only members were allowed to be there. I showed up as not a member and was actually refused the elements, despite the fact that I was on staff at the church. I just hadn't been accepted as a member. I wasn't allowed to take communion. Then on the other side, there's open communion. Open communion is, hey, everybody, anybody that wants to come on down, have a grab some cheese whiz, fill it off. It's going to be great. A lot of churches observe that. If you ever been to a Catholic mass, they don't tell you that if you're not Catholic, you're not supposed to go up. But if you read the book actually says, if you're not Catholic, don't come up. But nobody reads the book. All right, the books are sitting there. We're like trying to figure out how the kneeler thing works. We're putting our feet up on it. We don't know what's going on. We're confused. Everybody kneels. We're like, what? You know, we don't know what's going on. Everybody's supposed to be invited up and take the host and all that stuff. Catholic Church didn't used to be like that, by the way. They used to have actually armed enforcement to check whether you were excommunicated or not, whether you could participate. That changed in the second council in the 1960s. But then we have what we call close communion. That little thing that Jed read this morning telling you, if you're not a believer, you don't need to participate. Feel free to sit down. Tell them, Mom and Dad, if you know your children's spiritual condition, you know whether they participate. That's because we're not going to deny the Lord's table to anyone, but we want people to be aware of what it means and make sure they're given an opportunity to evaluate whether they should participate, whether they are followers of Christ or not. That's why we do it that way. I don't know if you realize that. And the reason that we do that is because it is not our job to tear the tares out. It is not our job to walk around and go, "You're not good enough for us. You don't belong in our church. You're not good enough." Now, it's painful. It's a painful way to live because it's much easier if you can just control everything about your environment. Wouldn't it be great if you got to pick your coworkers? Wouldn't it be great if you had complete control of which of your kids had to live with you? We would love to be able to make those kind of decisions, right? But we don't. God mixes us up. He invites us in. Even if we were very, very careful about what we identified as a tear, the possibility of us, if we had that power, ripping up somebody that belonged there is just too great. Jesus says, "You leave that to me. You leave that to me." Now, that does not mean that Jesus says you don't identify false doctrine. That's not what he says. He's not saying that you don't identify bad behavior. He's not saying that somebody in the church who is committing outright sin, lifestyle habitual sin, the church does not identify that and say, "That's sin." We got in all kinds of trouble by not telling people that sin was sin. We're dealing with all kinds of problems with that in the modern church because we refused to do that for the better part of a century. Not we, us, church, big C. Jesus' eschatology, Jesus' view of the end times, just check this out very briefly. Notice the patience that Jesus has with the other in the midst of his kingdom. That is extraordinary to me. That Jesus says, "You don't tear the tares out. You don't get to decide. I'm waiting." Why? Because something that looks like a tare might be wheat. And something that might look like wheat might be a tare. And it's not your job to call. We'll wait. Jesus says, it's in the harvest, the decision will be clear. It will be made. His judgment is based on substance, not appearance. And try as we might, we cannot see the substance of other people around us in the kingdom. We don't have X-ray vision to see their soul. Not even pastors. I know some people think we've got magic powers. We really do not. I can't tell whether you're a believer or not a believer based on looking at you. You can't either. We should be very cautious about that kind of stuff. We don't cast aside discernment. We make sure that we're aware of the potential of corruption. We make sure we stand for righteousness. I've always found that if you stand for righteousness, people that want to destroy you eventually will manage to blow themselves up. If you just stay true, I used to be very confrontational about "you're wrong, I'm right." I found that if I just sit there and very calmly answer in correct grammar, they get really annoyed and get angry and mad, and I'm okay with that. My job isn't to sit there and go, my job isn't to be the hammer. My job isn't to be the hammer. Honestly, often my job is just to be the bent nail. Jesus had earlier in the gospel, he had earlier stated about healthy trees being discerned by their fruit. And here he points out that we, and that even includes the angels, can't necessarily tell the difference between health and corruption until the final judgment. So we have an obligation as the church, we have an obligation to grow in righteousness, to take advantage of the good field that Jesus has planted us in, to grow to the best of our ability, to be righteous, to be holy, and spend a lot less time walking around going, you're a terror, you're a terror, you're a terror. When we withdraw from society because we are too righteous, we are already teetering on the precipice of arrogance. We are already teetering on self-righteous religiosity. We are called to be a part of the world. In fact, not only are we called to be a part of the world, we were planted in the field that is the world by the one who knew the enemy would plant the weeds right next to us. We have an obligation, a responsibility as the church, yes, to have discernment, yes, to be aware of wickedness and evil, but also to grow up until the end. One of the things that we forget about the gospel is that the gospel is not focused on what I get right now. The gospel is not about me being happy, righteous, holy in this moment. It is about God at work for all of creation in all of time. There is a harvest coming. There is a judgment coming. But while we're here, our job is to grow and work and be fruitful and let God sort out the weeds and the garbage. If there is one prayer we can pray, in conclusion of this, it is this. God, I'm just wheat. I trust you. God, I'm just one piece. Maybe I've been judgmental toward others. Maybe I've been religiously obsessed. Maybe I've thought so much about my own opinion and not how I am a part of the harvest of God. I'm the seed planted in the field of the world by the Son of Man. I've been so focused on so many other things rather than just being the seed, the grain, the harvest that you planted for others to grow and to bear fruit. Jesus, I'm not the judge. I'm just the wheat. I'm not the reaper. I'm not the fire. I'm just the wheat. Would you join me in a word of prayer? Jesus, it is difficult to always know and to discern who we are to be, when to stand. Help us to stand for righteousness, even when it is uncomfortable for us, not to attack wickedness. You will deal with the wickedness, but to stand for the righteousness, to be true to you, no matter what the world looks like, no matter how close the tares are, and trust that you are in control of the harvest. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and give you peace, and give you peace, and give you peace forever. My brothers and sisters, go in peace and be the church of Jesus Christ in a world that needs to hear